May I say, first of all, how very happy I am to be back on BBC Radio. It seems a long time, indeed it is a long time, since I was on the verge of becoming a child star in the Huey Green mould of the popular Midland Regional Follies in 1939. Just as it was really catching on, the show became a casualty of the Second World War. A war which more or less made Tommy Handley temporarily wiped me out. However, here I am back again, and in the 40 or so good, bad and indifferent years between, I've been involved in every facet of show business. Films, TV, stage, West End and everywhere else, concert, party, review, panto. I've acted, written, understudied, directed and produced. I've been a technical advisor, personal manager, T-boy, choreographer and stooge. I've starred in a TV commercial for Gravy Browning, which won a prize at Perpignan, and I've appeared in West End Cabaret and the Labour Exchange, sometimes on the same day. In other words, I have seen it all. But during all this time, the doors of the corporation have been closed to me. I can only surmise that this vault fuss on their part is due to a recent change of personnel on the fourth floor. A certain gentleman who's been elevated to a position with considerable clout has decided that it is in his interest to push a bit of work in my direction, hence my presence here now. This certain gentleman evidently prefers this arrangement to allowing me to tell a few stories elsewhere which feature himself. But you listeners are men and women of the world and will understand that, in spite of the amazing revelations you're going to hear in the coming weeks, I'm not going to say anything about him. In other words, I have been in showbiz far too long to even consider biting the hand that feeds me, let alone reveal the name of its owner. Right. This story is about Brian Allington. That isn't his real name, it isn't even his stage name. If I used real names during the coming weeks, I'd be forced to live abroad in a country with no extradition agreement. Brian Allington was on the box again last night. He's doing really well. It was about the fourth time I've seen him this month, and at a peak hour, too. It's a long time since I was on tour with him in a whodunit that never got to town. I remember him so well as a young actor. Well, that's misleading in a way. Brian couldn't really act at all, in the way I understand the word. The play we were in was Murder by the Book. It was about a sadistic author who invites seven of his close friends to spend a weekend at his cottage and then tells them he's going to expose all their terrible secrets in his next book. After dinner, they play hide-and-seek with the lights out, and one of them kills the host. Brian played the part of his personal secretary. I was the butler. I merely came on a couple of times to give the audience a chance to laugh at domestic servants generally and to give the cast time to change out of their dinner jackets and backless dresses. But Brian was intended to be a prime suspect throughout. The trouble was, no audience ever believed for a moment that this innocent-looking young chap could possibly have plunged the assegai into the author's chest and then heaved his body onto the desk. Even when he confessed at the end of the play, they still didn't believe him. They thought he was confessing to shield someone else. Brian had that quality. People trusted him. And when I said he couldn't act, well, that's exactly what I mean. And it isn't the same as acting badly. Brian only had to walk onto the stage to remind an audience that what they were watching was only a play. As soon as he spoke, he made all the other actors look like actors. After 6 weeks of a badly arranged tour, Brighton up to Newcastle, back to Bournemouth, up to Glasgow again, then over to Dublin, then up to Hull, Brian got wind of the fact that we were never going to see the bright lights of London's West End. He didn't risk offending the management by mentioning this. He merely told them that his half-sister was desperately ill in Zurich, and since they shared the same rare blood group, he had to fly over there and donate at least a quart. The management released him with a lot of public regret and then gleefully engaged someone even cheaper. During the tour, Brian had borrowed 15 quid from me, and before he left us, he asked me to make it a round figure, so I let him have another fiver. A fiver was a fiver in those days, and 20 quid represented 66 2/3 of my weekly salary. But as I waved him goodbye at the station, I never doubted I would get it back. It was only after the train had pulled out that I compared notes with the rest of the cast and discovered that Brian had borrowed a total of 85 quid from six of us. The other two actors he'd touched were pretty annoyed, but I think it's significant that the three ladies who'd parted would not hear a word against him. They were quite convinced that dear Brian would be sending them checks as soon as he sorted things out in Switzerland. One of them had given him a farewell present of a bottle of hog's liver tablets to replace the blood he was going to have drained off into his half-sister. I've not been in touch with any of those innocent ladies for many years, so I don't know whether they ever received their due. If not, then, now Brian is on television so much, this might be a good time to remind him of their existence with a view to reimbursement. A few years after the ill-fated tour ended in Aberdeen, wouldn't you know, I was acting in the West End. Not in Murder by the Book, needless to say, no, in a play which everyone assured me had been put on to make a tax loss for the backer. He was a respected businessman who'd made a fortune building modern airy slums. The story was that he loved showbiz and preferred to put his money into it than into the coffers of the Inland Revenue. Personally, I could never understand the logic of this. If it was true, why did he engage the cheapest cast he could find and then ask them to take cuts in salary after the first 2 weeks? Nevertheless, it was nice to be on Shaftesbury Avenue after so many years on the road, and I enjoyed going home to my little flat rather than to crummy digs in provincial cities indifferent to live theatre, particularly as I had recently formed a meaningful relationship with a young lady. Youngish. So every Saturday I used to check in early for the matinee to see if there was an announcement that the play was coming off, and when I didn't find it, was able to luxuriate in one more week of comparative security. After one of these Saturdays, just after the curtain came down on the second house, who should appear at the stage door but Brian Allington? He breezed into my dressing room unannounced, having convinced the stage doorkeeper that he was an old friend of mine. I was almost ready to leave and meet my girlfriend downstairs, but Brian settled down on the other stool and told me how thrilled he was to see me in the West End in what he described as an enormous hit. I told him we were just hanging on week by week. "Nonsense," he said, "you'll be here for years. I envy you, Jacko, you've got it made." His enthusiasm was beginning to get through to me. "Do you really think the play is that good? I haven't seen the play." "You haven't seen it? I wanted to see you. Then how do you know it's so good?" "I don't need to see it to know that, with all those wonderful reviews." "The reviews were terrible." "Not the ones I read. Anyway, reviews never matter at the grassroots. The man in the street doesn't pay any attention to the critics. The British man in the street and his wife like to make up their own minds. Take my word for it, you're in a smash hit." At this point, my date arrived. Nadia was the girl I mentioned earlier as being, at the time, a distinct possibility as a long-term partner. Brian was just as enthusiastic about her as he was about the play. He raved about her classic features and sophisticated charm and said how envious it made him feel. Then he told Nadia what a wonderful person I was, and how thrilled he was that I'd finally made it, and how he looked forward to the other successes that he knew were coming my way. Suddenly he looked round and asked if we couldn't drink to our reunion. I didn't have anything in the dressing room. It wasn't the sort of room in which one entertains. In fact, it was the sort of room a derelict might quietly starve to death in, ignored by the social services. Nadia had the answer. "Go and get a bottle from Gerald downstairs. He's always got plenty." "Or I could pop out and get a bottle at the off-license round the corner," said Brian, not moving a muscle. Nadia wouldn't hear of such a thing. So off I went downstairs to catch Gerald Bannerman, who played the drunken doctor so realistically. He was very decent about it and made me a present of a bottle of Chilean Cabernet Sauvignon, the only one left out of the 24 he'd brought in on the Monday. He lent me 2 glasses and a tooth mug as well. When I got back to my room, Brian was telling Nadia how very popular I'd been with the Murder by the Book company. This gave me what I thought was a good opportunity to bring up the subject of the fiver he'd borrowed just before he left and the 15 he had already owed. "Jacko's got a memory like an elephant where money is concerned," said Nadia, disloyally, I thought. Brian laughed, but he saw I wasn't amused. He immediately said how pleased, how very, very pleased he was that I'd reminded him. "Not like him," he said, "to let a thing like that slip his mind. When a friend gave one a helping hand, then the least one can do is remember and do the decent thing. It wasn't possible," he said, "to give it back to me this moment, because that very morning he'd given all his spare cash to a bailiff to save his old nanny from a brutal eviction order. But he assured me I should have a check first post on Tuesday." "That's fine," I said. "Fine." Nadia looked at me impatiently. "We were having such a nice chat," she said, "and you had to bring up sordid old money." I gave my best disarming shrug and changed the subject. "How is your half-sister?" I asked Brian. He looked at me blankly. "She's fine," he said. "You remember you had to leave the company to go to her aid." "That's right, of course. I'm so glad you reminded me. I'm surprised you could forget a thing like that." "I'll never forget. It was just that you mentioned it out of context," he turned to Nadia. "Poor darling, she was robbed by a gang of Corsican hotel thieves in Antibes." "Robbed?" I said. "Lost everything, passport, traveller's checks, credit cards, the lot. Absolutely stranded. It cost me a fortune to replace everything and pay the hotel bill and so forth. But she's a sweet girl. I'd do anything for her." "You told us you had to go to Zurich to give her some of your rare blood." "Ah, yes, you're quite right to mention that. I'm afraid she's always tended to turn to me for help. And there have been so many emergencies. Poor darling, I won't say she's accident-prone, but let's say she's been very unlucky." "Odd you should forget a thing like that," I said. "Giving your blood is so very basic." "Oh, it's happened too many times, that's the trouble. There are only two other potential donors, and they're in Western Australia." "Jacko," said Nadia, "Brian's come a long way to see you tonight, and I'm sure he doesn't want to be reminded of unhappy things that happened long ago." I said I didn't know Brian had come a long way. I was beginning to feel hungry, and it was now well past the time when I'd expected to have my knees under the table at my little flat opposite Nadia. "I only came from Brighton," said Brian, "but when I read in the Argus that you were in this smash show, I felt I had to jump on the train and bask in the old reflected glory. I would have come to the play, but I was delayed by a stranded Norwegian at Victoria. I helped him find a hotel. But it's great to see you, Jacko." He shared out the remaining plonk between himself and Nadia. "Now I must dash off and catch the train." He embraced us both and repeated most of the effusive things he'd said already, and off he went. Nadia was quite grumpy with me over the supper, which had been simmering away all day in my new electric casserole. I'd gone to a lot of trouble over that stew, bay leaves, button, mushrooms, red wine, the lot. After a milk stout apiece, drunk in silence, I asked her to come out with it. "What's the matter?" "The way you acted with Brian. It was just as if you didn't believe him or something. It was as if you didn't think he would send you the check on Tuesday." "It was just an instinct I had. Call it my masculine intuition." "If that's what it is, it's feeding you false information." "Of course he'll send it. He'll send it at the same time he sends the 20 quid to me." "What 20 quid to you?" "The 20 I lent him." "Lent him when?" "When you were borrowing the wine from Gerald." "I was only gone 5 minutes." "What does that mean?" "That he's a fast worker." "I thought he was a friend of yours." "I never said that. He's someone I worked with ages ago, someone who owes me 20 quid. You as well now." "He's trying to get some money together to help a poet get out of Czechoslovakia." "What?" "A poet. Brian is trying to help him to emigrate." "With 20 quid? I shouldn't think 20 quid would get a bloody hamster out of Czechoslovakia, let alone a poet." "Poet, really? You're so cynical, Jacko." "I had good cause to be." "It was the reasons Brian gave that got under my skin. The rare blood group, the thieves, not just ordinary thieves, they had to be Corsicans. And it was a poet he was helping, a Czechoslovakian poet. Brian never wanted money to pay his rent or his phone bill or keep up maintenance payments. With Brian, it had to be something exotic." Needless to say, I never received the promised check, never heard a word of any kind. And after that evening at the theatre, when Brian called round, things between Nadia and me were never the same. I was the villain of the piece, so far as she was concerned, and the more I attempted to justify my attitude, the wider the gulf between us grew. In the end, Nadia came to the conclusion that I was even more cynical than the husband from whom she was having a trial separation, and she went back to him. Several years passed, with no news of Brian. Once, only once, in all that time did I hear of him, and that was very problematical. I bumped into one of the girls from the old Murder by the Book company, and she told me she'd seen Brian, well, she was sure it was Brian, leaving Television Centre one day. She called after him, but he didn't hear her. She ran after him, he crossed the street, and she waved, but just as she thought she'd attracted his attention, he jumped on a bus and vanished into the night. Maddening, she said. Because they would have had so much to talk about. He'd always been so sweet, she said. I agreed with her. I said Brian was a really wonderful human being and how much I'd profited from knowing him. What I didn't say was, what about the money he owes you? It would have been a waste of time. I knew her reaction would have been the same as Nadia's. And then, late one night, he phoned me. Jacko, it's your old mate, Brian. Great news, Jacko, old chum. I've landed a plum job. I've given up acting and taken a regular job. A new PR firm starting up. It's a terrific break for me, and the best thing about it is that it means I shall be able to pay off all my debts. I've felt terrible about owing you that money all these years. How is Nadia, by the way? I told him she was no longer part of my life. Shame, lovely girl. I must get in touch with her and pay her back, too. But my debt to you goes back even further. I must settle that first. Could we have lunch tomorrow? Yes, I'm free. Great. 1 o'clock at the piazza. Is that okay with you? Very nice. Excellent. But I do have one problem. My heart sank. Could you possibly put me up tonight? Never mind a bed. Is there room for me to curl up on the floor? I'm in North London, and I shall never catch the train to Sevenoaks. You've left Brighton, then? Oh, ages ago. I'm looking for a place near Trafalgar Square so that I can be near my work. What do you say? Would it be an awful bore if I came round in a few minutes? Well, I thought, considering he's giving me lunch tomorrow and I'm going to get my money back, I suppose I can't very well refuse. All right, I said. You're a pal, Jacko. I'll bring a bottle along and we can have a nightcap and chat about old times. Half an hour later, Brian arrived. Needless to say, there was no sign of any nightcap, nor any luggage. The next morning he borrowed my shaving things and had a bath and rushed off to an appointment with the PR firm. We didn't talk much. Brian was on the phone most of the time, and not all the calls were local. He promised to settle up for these when we had our lunch at the piazza. When he arrived, he was bubbling with excitement. "It's all fixed," he said. "Signed the contract this morning. I start work on Monday. Let's order lunch." Egged on by Brian, I disregarded all considerations of cost and ordered a very good meal. So did he. Over the veal masala and a bottle of Tenuta di Capizzana 81, he told me all about the wonderful opportunities his new job had opened up. Travelled to New York and L.A., where the firm were going to open offices, and all the famous clients Brian would be wining and dining. Over the coffee, he brought up the question of the money he was going to repay. I was relieved. I'd begun to think I should have to bring up the subject myself. "Now, the way I propose to pay you is this," he said, "by post-dated cheque. I shan't get my first salary for 3 weeks, so I'm going to give you a cheque dated a month from today. Is that okay?" I was disappointed, but what could I say? It had been a very good lunch. "Yes, that's okay." "Excellent. Now, there's one other problem. Getting this job organized has cost me a lot in entertaining and chasing around. It's left me terribly short of ready cash. What would make life a great deal easier for me would be for you to give me a cheque for, say, round £100, and I'll make my post-dated cheque out for the £100, plus the amount I already owe you, and Nadia's £20 as well." I felt a distinct throbbing in the temples. £100, I said. "No chance. Impossible." "What about 50? He took out his cheque-book. "I've only got just enough to see me through to the end of the month." "How much is that?" 60-odd. "That's fine. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll lend you another 100, so you'll know that next month you'll have a balance. That's 100 plus the 60 you're lending me, plus 20 I owe you from way back, and Nadia's 20. He started writing. That's 200. Is that enough, Jacko? Would you like me to let you have some more? No, I said, no. OK, now, if you want more next month, you know where to come. Just let me have your cheque for 60. Today is the 19th. You know what I did? I made out a cheque payable to Brian Allington for £60, my balance at the bank being 62. Looking back, I realised I should have sought psychiatric help. Brian took my cheque, looked at it for a moment, and stuffed it into his wallet. "Thanks, Jacko, you're a real pal." He tore his own cheque out of the book, folded it over, and tucked it into my breast pocket. "Pay that in first thing tomorrow morning, then it'll be safe until it's honoured 4 weeks from today. By the way, do you mind if we go Dutch?" He beckoned for the bill. By this time, I was traumatised. If Brian had got up, removed my jacket, and torn the shirt from my back, I believe I should have sat there and let him. My share of the lunch came to enough to keep me for 10 days in the frugal style I adopt when waiting for something to turn up. I didn't hurry to put the cheque in the bank, knowing that it had not been cleared for a month, but when I received a 19p TV repeat fee for a programme that had been sold to Brunei, I thought I might as well bank Brian's cheque at the same time. I took it out of the breast pocket of the suit I'd been wearing on the day of the lunch. I looked at it. My knees gave way. I sat down. I looked out of the window, blinked a few times, and looked back at the cheque. There was no doubt about it. He'd written out the correct amount, he'd filled in the correct figures. The name J. Kingston Platt was clearly written, so was the date. But he hadn't signed it. The questions flashed into my mind like a speeded-up montage. Where was Brian? Could I find him? Had he done it on purpose? Could I trace the PR firm he was working for? Would the bank help me to trace him? Where would next month's rent come from? These questions swiftly changed into overall turmoil. I told myself not to panic. I didn't listen to my own instructions. I think I was really in danger of flipping my trolley. Fortunately, I was saved by a phone call. It was an availability inquiry. By sheer instinct, I was able to discuss the possibility of a summer season at the least popular of all East Coast resorts with a feigned eagerness indistinguishable from the real thing. I could be wrong about that because I never heard from the man again. But the call did serve to snap me out of the black mood brought on by the unsigned cheque and the knowledge that I'd let myself be conned by Brian yet again. That was the last time I ever saw him in person. I wrote to him, care of the bank, and also care of equity, but eventually my letters were returned. Then, 6 months ago, I saw him on the box. Sprucer. Leaner. And putting his case very convincingly. I won't tell you the name of the constituency he is actually a candidate for, but I should think he has a very good chance of getting in. And they've already announced that he'll be speaking for at least 3 minutes on the next party political broadcast. It's my belief he will be elected. And if he's backed the winning party, then I anticipate a cabinet post within 2 years. I'd be surprised if he isn't in the top job of all within 5. It's not just that he's an ex-actor and we tend to imitate America in everything, but that he is a wonderful front man. I can't decide whether to ask him for the money he owes me now or wait until he moves up in the corridors of power. If I delay too long, he might get into a position to have me liquidated, because I know he will never part with money without putting up a fight. On the other hand, he might choose to placate me with a few favours like a government grant, a cushy job in the Arts Ministry, or even a useful title. Who knows? He might even be able to get me onto Desert Island Discs.
J. Kingston Platt's Showbiz Handbook was written and performed by Peter Jones. The producer was Pete Atkin. Next week, our showbiz veteran recounts the woeful tale of a gala night in Venice.
The Comedy Club on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And entering its hallowed portal now, a man who, it says here, and I think this is true, a much-loved comedy writer, performer, director and novelist, Andy Hamilton. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I think that's an accurate description, isn't it? I'd say you were much loved.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, the people who despise me tend not to come up to me in the street and say, do you know what? I can't stand you.
Mm. Although in this day and age of social media, they're more likely to say it out loud to you on there than, you know,
I don't hold back anymore, do they? Yeah, I don't have a phone, so...
That's the correct thing.
So I don't... Yeah, so it's possible that I'm much hated.
Yeah.
But, well, I'll just never know about it.
Well, I'll redo it. Joining me is a much-loved, or possibly much-hated, comedy writer, performer, director and novelist, Andy Hamilton.
BBC Balance.
That's exactly what that was. Which you would know all about, of course, because people listening to this will know you from your, not just your work with the BBC, but we should talk about that, given that this is 4 Extra, because you are, of course, one of the voices of Radio 4, and thus 4 Extra, which you've been doing for a long time. Was Weekending the first thing you wrote on back in the day for Radio 4?
Yes, in 1976 I started. On Weekending, and Weekending, for people who are too young to know, was a weekly topical sketch show. Quite an interesting discipline from a writing point of view, because the maximum length of a sketch was usually about 1 minute 40 seconds, and the sketches were supposed to be funny, but they also were supposed to have an argument. You know, you couldn't just write a string of random jokes about a story. So it was quite a good place to start, because it was a bit like doing summary at O level. Do you remember you used to hate doing it? But it was a good discipline, wasn't it? It taught you. That was where I started.
Well, my first ever joke professionally was on Weekending as well, but it was just as it was axed, which was a sort of
just as the show.
I think on the last series I got my first ever joke on it, and then it kind of went.
I mean, I kind of understood it had been on a very 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 long time. However, it had been a great nursery for a hell of a lot of writers.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult. Maybe that hasn't quite been replaced.
I mean, well, Newsjack, I suppose.
That's the equivalent, isn't it?
The current equivalent, and that remains to be seen whether or not, you know, those sort of names. Because, as you rightly said, you know, the people that came through, the writers, I mean, it was a writer's nursery.
It was.
For names you are very familiar with.
Yeah.
And did you feel that at the time? Was it when you were there and your contemporaries, was there a sense of okay, we're the next generation of this?
I'm not consciously, no. I mean, my memory of it is that it was a lot of fun. The Radio Light Entertainment Corridor, as it was then, had a section at the end where there was a writer's room, which fundamentally was you opened the door and there was a wall of cigarette smoke. And there would be like 7 writers in there, maybe working on different things. There was a phone in the corner. This phone, how naive is this? They left a phone in a room full of freelance writers. So every now and then, one of the writers would pick up the phone and say, what time is it in Australia? And you'd say, I thought I'm going to ring my cousin. And they would ring their cousin in Australia. That's how. And we used to get in trouble for playing. I remember we played cricket in the corridor once and brought down a strip light.